So today's guest on my inaugural episode of the new Reading People podcast is Alex Falcone. And Alex is a comedian and writer who lives in Portland, Oregon, like me. And he won Portland's Funniest Person this year, which is a pretty competitive contest, as there's a lot of comedy talent in Portland these last few years. Alex has appeared on the show Portlandia a few times and at numerous comedy festivals. He's also got a parody novel, which is a young adult romance called Unwrap My Heart. And it's about a high school girl who falls in love with not a vampire this time, but a very sexy mummy. So in addition to all this, he's most known in my house as the guy who's been teaching my wife, Molly Elwood, at some of the stand-up comedy classes he does. So hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. That's a most known for teaching your wife is kind of a weird
phrase. Well, to me, yeah, might need some more context there. But was that a good rundown of your major accomplishments?
It's great. It was almost verbatim from my website, but with like enough personal touches.
Right, might sound a little familiar to you. I recognize that. Okay, so let's see. Were you out late last night by any chance doing stand up comedy?
I was. Yeah, sorry about that. It was really just we had a normal show that ended around like 10 or 10:30, and then some old friends were in town, so we stayed up all night talking about comedy.
Gotcha.
That's why we're doing this at the comedian time of 1:30 in the afternoon.
Right. The that's both the poker player and the comedian's
morning. Also a good poker time. Poker morning.
Yeah. So let's start out with some questions since this is the first episode of this thing, just to give people context. So I'm going to ask Alex about, you know, how reading people's behavior comes in handy in his profession in comedy.
You're not going to talk about how it's come in handy in your life first, or like...
Oh,
I'm not going to direct you. It's your show. Never mind. Sorry, Sam. Sorry.
We can save that for another episode, or I'll come on your podcast.
Yeah, that's true. You should talk.
Oh, that's
about.
Right. Alex has a podcast too. I should mention.
I have so many things. It feels just like a list of stuff that I'm doing, and none of it's great. It's like I have a lot of okay stuff.
What's your podcast called again?
The podcast is called Read It and Weep, and it's people pay us to watch movies that they want to hear my opinion on. It used to be all bad stuff, and then we decided we deserve to be happy. So now it's usually like we pick a theme, like it's jungle themed movie month, and then people who donate to the show get to choose what we're going to watch. So it's just a weird adventure through movies. And I don't know anything about movies, but my friend Anthony Lopez, who's also a comic, he does. So that's kind of what we got, kind of a Goofus and Gallant vibe to it.
Oh yeah, Alec, he's a very funny guy.
Yeah,
I've seen him perform a good amount too.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start out with, and so emailing with you a little bit before the show, my first thought that was that reading people in comedy and stand-up comedy could be broken down into two categories, basically reading the crowd as a whole and kind of reading individuals when you're doing one-on-one interactions. So we'll talk a little bit about those things first. And then at the end of that, after that, I want to talk to you about how doing comedy has maybe made you a better reader of people in your social and, you know, professional situations. So
that's great.
So let's start out. I'll start out with a quote that you sent me via email, where you said essentially the following: every joke is about reading a series of crowds and making judgments based on that. Every joke is funny or not because of crowd readings. And then during shows, adjusting that based on how you're reading the room and what they want. So if I'm understanding what you said correctly, it sounds like you're saying even before you're in front of a crowd, when you're working on your comedy by yourself, you're always thinking about the psychology of your audience, how it will be perceived by the population as a whole. Is that what I was understanding when you said that?
Yeah, totally.
Is that correct?
I think that's a great way to say it. I mean, it's basically every joke is a theory, and then you test that theory with an audience. So you're like, my theory is if I say these words in this order, people are going to laugh. And then you test that theory every night, and based on whether or not they laugh or not, or how they react, you adjust your theory, and then you try another one. So it's just a series of guess and checks. And so a lot of comics, I think, do it very subconsciously, where it's like you just success or fail, change something, success or fail. And then you do that 1,000 times, and eventually you get to a very successful theory. And then that's your joke that you take on the road. And because I teach it, and I just the way I like to approach problems, I think of it a little more explicitly than that, where I try to think like, this is what I'm trying to accomplish, and am I accomplished not just making people laugh, but also like, here's how I want them to feel at every point along this journey. And then I have to, like, in the moment of telling the joke, decide if they're responding the way I expect them to be responding for that emotional part of the joke. And then
it's almost like you're modeling an audience in your head, you know, with all these experiments you're running. Basically, if you think of every every set as an experiment where you're testing out whether your view of what's funny actually aligns with, you know, the average crowd's view of what's funny. And the more you do it, the more your internal model of the various types of audiences you encounter are become more accurate.
Absolutely. There's one tiny quibble that I would have is just that I think it's totally normal from the outside to think of it as whether or not it's funny. And the way I try to think of it, it's not whether it's funny. I know it's funny because I liked it. I laughed at it. So it has like, it's already succeeded in its first audience. That's why I wrote it down. So really what I'm testing is not, is this funny? It's, am I showing the audience why I thought it was funny? So about whether, also saying something is or is not funny is a weird way of making the subjective thing seem objective. And it's not, it's just, I know that I like this and have I shown you why I like it enough that you will also like it. And so when a joke doesn't work, it's not like, oh, this is not funny or I'm not funny. It's like, I'm not communicating well enough right now.
Yeah, that's a real good point. It makes me think of Twitter and how, you know, Twitter is such a constrained place to construct a joke. And it's like you can see the difference between phrasing the same idea slightly different ways can completely kill the joke because it's just not communicating. Even though the idea might be completely the same, it's just if you're communicating it slightly off kilter, then the audience is not receiving what you see as funny in the joke, right?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter is basically just the world's largest open mic. And just like open mics, it's largely toxic.
yeah, it makes me think what you said there. It makes me think of how, you know, writers are kind of building audiences in their minds, or, you know, they might already have them. Good writers might already have them built in where they kind of have this sense of how will this, they're seeing the communication from other people's perspective all the time. You know, they're weighing it like, how will this person see it? How will this person see it? How will this kind of person see it?
Yeah. And, you know, as somebody now having written, I wrote that novel last year and that you mentioned, and it's so horrifying to do long-term creative stuff when you've been doing stand-up for a long time, because like you create this model of an audience in your head when you write a book and then you put it out in the world. And if you find out you were wrong, it's too late. That's your book. Like I'm used to taking a joke and trying it 1,000 times before I decide if it's good or not. And with a book, you get like, you know, 4 friends and 2 editors to read it. And you're like, I have to hope that you guys are right, that this was representative. And that's terrifying to me, especially because like sometimes it's bad and you're like, this is too late. We just spent 2 years of my life working on this thing. It's not great, or it's not communicating right, which is what I should try to be careful with what I'm saying. It's not communicating the way I want it to be. Maybe the next one's better.
Right.
And that's so horrible. And so like what I constantly want to do is take my novel like offline and make a series of line edits and put it up and see if the reviews change and then do it again. And just because I'm so used to being able to iterate.
Yeah, then I think you could do that. You know, I think with print on demand, I mean, especially you can do a second revision or a third revision.
You certainly could. Although I think at some point somebody would be like, why do I have volume 97 of this novel? This novella?
Yeah. Hey, most people aren't going to even notice, you know.
Yeah, I enjoy that aspect of the short form, too, is that I get to test it so much more. Although you're using some great scientific language about running this experiment, but I think scientists would be horrified by comedy as experiment because I'm testing 200 variables at a time, that like every time. So I'm testing, is this, I changed 3 words in this joke and I'm testing that, but I have no, like, I also might've been talking faster or slower. I might be smiling or not smiling. You know, I'm tired or depending on how
so many variables,
a million things, there's just so many knobs at any time. And that's why you have to do a lot of volume to sort of like hope that you're equalizing that. I mean, the stakes are pretty low too. So if it's like, I delivered this differently 5 times and it only worked twice. I don't know what's wrong with it. I'll just write a new joke and then you start over. So like the stakes are low at least, but
it gives me an idea for a Black Mirror where you're a comedian in the future running simulations of your stand-up comedy set millions of times, you know, until you're like, you become a master comedian overnight.
I
or
do
something,
feel like
know?
there is some sort of like robot comic that is going to be able to do that in a way, and it's where like it's easy to think that that's like what a silly idea that you could genuinely get good at. That is like, I just have this robot in a simulated comedy environment who tells this thing over and over and over again until it's actually really, really funny.
Right, or they just reach these weird, you know, unforeseen solutions to comedy where they say these outlandish things that no human would have thought of, and people are just dying laughing. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like some artificial intelligent approach to comedy that nobody can see coming.
So interesting, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, let's get onto the behavior a little bit. So moving on to reading crowds, let's talk a little bit about how a crowd's behavior or the vibes in a crowd can influence how you approach things. Can you think of anything offhand, off the top of your head, that where two very different crowds might completely sway how you approach a set you're doing?
Well, it's not that I have to make an absolute decision about anything. Like, I'm constantly tweaking as I'm talking as well. I'm changing in the moment. So, like, I'm constantly changing gears and talking slower or faster or adding things or changing the jokes that I'm going to tell. The beginning of his autobiography, Steve Martin said, like, his main memory of doing stand-up was having your brain and your mouth be in two different places all the time. And it's really what happens when you've done it for a while. Is I'm telling the joke, but it doesn't take any... I don't need any brain cycles to tell the joke because I've done it a lot of times before. So mostly I can spend that time looking at people, making decisions based on that. Like, should I change what I was planning on doing or just how I'm doing it? Do I need to be more like, I don't know, this audience seems kind of quiet. Maybe they want me to be just a little slower and a little more chill because if I'm yelling at them, they'll be intimidated, or they're kind of rowdy and they want me to yell at them and give them more of a tough love. And like, so I'm constantly doing those little things. Or, I mean, it's not always productive. I'm also doing totally unproductive things. Like, I'll pick one person in the audience and be like, this person hasn't laughed at anything. All I care about is him. And then I'll spend the whole night just trying to figure out how to get that guy to laugh. And if he doesn't, then I'll feel devastated no matter how the rest of the show went.
What are some things you look for before you even go on stage to know what a crowd might be like? So, you know, when you're behind stage, is it important to see how a crowd's reacting to the jokes of the guy in front of you?
Yeah. Like, there's certainly a risk of over analyzing a crowd before you go out that I tell a lot of young comics, like, it's easy to prejudge an audience and then be wrong. And that's a good way to do a bad job, is by assuming that an audience wants certain things. But there's definitely, like, the main thing that I look for right now is just age. So I had a class graduation show recently, and the person who brought by far the most friends to her graduation show was a woman in her 80s. And so, like, half the crowd was her friends. And so for me, that doesn't mean they're not, like, it doesn't mean I have to change a lot of things, but certainly all of my jokes that have references to movies from the early 90s are not going to land as well with them. Also, it's more important with a crowd like that I try to win them over from an early on. Cause like, if I come out and I start talking about something dirty, they might be like, oh, this, what a nasty boy. So I might front load my set with a couple of things where I say something nice about my wife, or I talk about like how much I like children or something that just makes them think, oh, what a nice boy. And then later I can just lose that trust.
Right. Right.
But like, I know I have to win them over. So like, the age is certainly a big part of it. Drunkenness is also crucial. If a crowd is real rowdy, then I'm going to do shorter jokes so that I can keep their attention better. And I'm not going to, if they talk during my set, I'm not going to take it personally because I know they're not able to control their volume very well. And a lot of the time, like, because I do a lot of like weekends where you do an early show Friday and a late show Friday, and the late show is always going to be rowdier, also more tired. So like, I'm going to make some adjustments based on that to try to make it easier for them. Because what I don't want to do is, if I just assume every crowd is exactly the same, then I come out and I start doing the joke and it's not working, then I think, oh, I'm failing right now. Instead of like, oh, they're just tired, so I just need to talk a little slower, bring them in. And this is like, they don't know how much the other crowd laughed, so I just need to talk to them at their level and have them make sure they have a good time for what they're expecting.
Mm-hmm. Is there something that comes to mind where you completely changed your approach based on a really unusual crowd? Does anything like that come to mind where you just did a very different style than you were used to?
Yeah, I should have a great example for this, but right now they're all blurring together. I can think of one of the things that I think that happens a lot is that I don't have to change the whole thing, but just like individual moments and just make sure everyone's on board. So like, for example, I did a show with a friend of mine recently where we did a fundraiser for a high school. And he has a joke that he's been doing for a while about how his parents got divorced and how his dad did all these stereotypical divorced dad stuff, like buying a Corvette and stuff. And when we got to this, we didn't know that it was a religious high school. And so when he said, how many of you have divorced parents? No one clapped. And it was, I've never seen, normally it's like 50, 60% of people in the audience have divorced parents. And right. he says, and it was, I just had to watch him, like, his face fell and he panicked for a half a second. But then the joke works the same. Instead of being, then you're just telling people a unique story instead of a universal one. So instead of like, you all know how dads buy he's like, well, here's what you don't know. Your dad is just like one divorce away from owning a Corvette. And as soon, and so he tells the story now as like this, he's the unique weirdo and they still love it. You just have to present it. What doesn't work is if you present something weird as if it's everybody. So if you're like, you all know how, and then you say something that no one's ever done, you'll lose them.
Right. So what kind of, are there specific body language or verbal things you look for when you perform, like any signs that you get that a crowd's not feeling things? Does anything pop out? You know, I guess it's some of the obvious stuff that we would all know to look
for.
Well,
you look for, I mean, obviously like laughing and not laughing and talking and stuff, and crossed arms are a good indication of what people are going to be like. One thing that I think I've noticed that probably not a lot of people realize is there's a thing that happens when people are on the early side of dating. So they've been like less than a year together, where they go to comedy shows together and they will constantly glance at each other to see if the other person is laughing. And if the other person is not laughing, they will not laugh. So they're constantly gauging whether it's okay in this relationship to laugh at certain jokes. So if I do a show and I see a lot of people glancing at each other during jokes, it's like, oh, this is a lot of younger people on dates. And so for them, I'm probably not going to talk about a lot of deep relationship stuff. I want to talk about things that they're not, that's going to be non-controversial to these younger couples. And that also happens at like corporate events where you'll see people like looking at each other. They'll all be looking at the one. They'll all look at the boss. Like, are we allowed to laugh at this joke? Boss, let me find out.
So you
can kind of watch where people are checking in. And with that one in particular, it's usually effective to just talk about it. And which is, I know from the poker world, you're going to get a lot of, if you get information on somebody, you're going to keep it to yourself for the most part. But in comedy, it's like, oh, everyone's looking at that guy. I'm like, is this the boss? Why is everybody looking at him for permission to laugh? And that in and itself will be funny.
That's funny. Yeah, that's pretty funny. I often wonder about how those corporate events go, because I can just see so many opportunities for weird, you know, because the workplaces can be so on edge about what can they say and what can be funny. So
yeah, absolutely. So for them though, if I talk about like kids and dogs and like, I could talk about more universal stuff. Here's where I'm going to talk about consent, you guys. I'm not going to like bring out my important big guns for them. That's why some comics don't like to do that sort of thing. I'm fine changing gears because I have a couple of other gears to go into. So I'm like, whatever, it's your nickel. If you want me to talk about someone else, we will. I'm not confrontational.
I'm thinking of a new niche for you or another comedian where you are the HR comic where you come in after weird things have happened and you make a funny bit about, you know, like somebody said something inappropriate and.
One thing I did was I did some corporate improv comedy back in the day before I was a stand-up, and we got hired one time to do a warehouse like Christmas party, and the CEO announced right before introducing us that they were laying off 10% of the staff. And then they're like, and now comedy. Like, so our, like, the whole point was for us to distract from the fact that a bunch of people were about to lose their job at Christmas. Wow. So that one, like, and there's no saving that. Then sometimes it's better to see, oh, this crowd is a lost cause. I'm just going to have fun for me and go home. This one's just a paycheck.
Just do whatever you feel like. Yeah. And be like, I'm probably not coming back here.
This is never going to happen again. This is not good for any of us. Let's just mess around. Also with corporate comedy, a lot of the time, they like talking about stuff that is relevant to them. They like talking about their work environment. So if I am doing a corporate event and it seems like a lot of people work for the same, if everyone's working for the same company or something, or everyone's talking, like, I'm going to ask the boss a question or ask them something about their lives. And then I'm going to do more crowd work because it's about them. And so they'll be really enthralled with it.
Now, you said something about crossed arms. Yeah. And I know for most people that's, you know, that's perceived as somebody who's not engaged, somebody who's kind of not wanting to be there. I know that's the general perception, right? I've often thought that's kind of like overplayed. Like, some people just like to cross their arms because they're comfortable doing it.
It's really dependent on your body type. I have kind of a shelf for my arms to sit on right there, so it's kind of nice.
Yeah, because I find myself doing that in situations and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't do that because people perceive that as being standoffish. Do you think it really, in a comedy context, do you generally perceive it as being people being closed off and
a lot of people with their arms crossed, then I usually assume something else has happened. I feel like something is going on with everybody. And that's where it gets, this is where I spend more time doing even slightly subtler investigations into, is when I'm not the only comic and I haven't seen what everybody else has done. So if I come out and there's a lot of crossed arms, I might think, oh, somebody else messed up. Like, so then I have to investigate from stage without making it obvious, like, who hurt you? And
What are their frowns? Are there, is somebody?
And so if that happens, basically, like, usually the easiest thing to do there to win everybody over is just do something fun quickly and just show, oh, I'm safe. I'm not that other person. I'm going to actually be funny here. Or especially in Portland, you get a lot of audiences where somebody said something that the audience perceived as racist or sexist or something. And if I just show early on that I'm woke enough for them, you know, I tell some then that's when I do tell a joke about consent, and then I win everybody to my side, and they're like, oh, this guy's okay. The cross arms, like, individually is not a big deal. Also, you know, I definitely see comics who see, like, someone in the front row with crossed arms and they'll start, like, going after them, and you know, sometimes someone has a real terrible day and they still have to go on this date that they agreed to. And so, like, if you're not enjoying yourself, it might not be for me to investigate. That might only make it worse. So I try to only do when it's, like, larger group behaviors.
I was just thinking, you must have this kind of, comedians must kind of develop this sixth sense of reading a crowd, you know, when you come out and, like you talked about, seeing a certain number of arms crossed, there must just be this whole kind of radar that you have, even if it, even unconsciously, where you just automatically pick up that the crowd is, you know, some percentage are crossing their arms. There's, like, some tight faces that don't look, not non-loose faces, and, you know, you must just kind of pick that up really quickly. You learn to pick that stuff up really quickly, you know, right?
I think people who are good at comedy have that to some extent, or they wouldn't have gotten where they are. But definitely, because I'm still, you know, I'm a, like, a pro-am kind of comedian, so I still do, I'm doing a lot of local bar shows with up-and-coming people, and a lot of them do not have any idea how they're coming across. And so they just don't know why things aren't working. So they'll be like, oh man, that crowd was really tight. That was, like, what a bad crowd. And I was like, well, they were great for me. Do you think maybe it was the open with something kind of racist and they didn't like you the whole time? So, like, there's definitely people don't all have that, especially because there's, like, a lot of people in comedy who have social anxiety. And I don't know why that is, but a lot of people with social anxiety come into comedy. And so it's a lot of people who are not good at reading rooms generally. And then they're like, but, and I came in here to talk about whatever I want. And so then they'll just alienate the crowd and not know what has happened.
Right. It's my thing. I don't have to conform to anyone.
Yeah. There's a lot of that kind of attitude from people who are bad at reading crowds. And it does end up with just people making the crowd feel weird and they don't know why. And, like, when I'm booking people to do a show with me, that's one of the things that I look for the most, is people who, like, clearly can tell how they're coming across. Because if you don't know, an example I like to use, I had a student for a little while who used to be a drug dealer, and he had this great story about this that started with him, like, smoking pills behind a closed Blockbuster. And it was a very funny story. And then he, like, cleaned up his life and went and became a personal trainer. And he, like, left comedy, came back 6 months later in great shape, shaved his mustache. He's, like, tan, bronze, beautiful, beautiful skin. And then he would start telling the same story, and the audience hated it. It was a very funny story, but it sounded like a lie, because he just didn't realize that he came across as an Adonis now and less as a scumbag. And so, and that's totally a fixable thing, where you just say, look, I know I look like a personal trainer right now, but actually I used to have this life. And then you tell the same story and it works way better, because you know why it's not working. And part of that is just just trying it, and you see a few times it's not working. Also, sometimes it's just, like, somebody else points out, like, oh, by the way, you never noticed this, but when you say it, this is how I hear what you're saying. This is how I interpret it. And then that changes your opinion. So, like, a lot of times you have a joke that's funny to you because you have this perfect train of, you know, 1,000 different facts in your head. And because of that train, joke. But if you take one car out of the middle, it's not, the train doesn't work. And this is not a great metaphor, but, like, you take one piece out of the middle, the whole thing falls apart. And so the audience doesn't know all those 1,000 things about you. So if they're missing one or two pieces of information. Right. So a lot of time early on, you tell a joke and people don't laugh. And the intuition is, oh, the joke's not funny enough. But really, it's that the setup isn't clear enough.
They don't see what's in your head, because it's kind of like the elephant in your own mind. It's kind of like you... they're not seeing the small elephants that are in your own room in your mind.
Are you sure the small elephants is a better metaphor than train cars?
I mean, we could combine it like small elephants on the train. Yeah. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean because, like, you know, I try my hand at my amateur comedy on Twitter like everybody does, and sometimes I have something that I think is ingenious and funny, and I'll do it, and it's just crickets. And I'm like, when I think about it more, it's like, oh, they weren't seeing it from the same way, and I left out kind of an assumption of something that was in my mind, right? Yeah,
and when you're performing, you have this all these added variables, so you could just like, oh, this joke didn't work. All of a sudden, that's worked 1,000 times. And then I go back and listen to the recording of it, and it's like, oh, I just like was kind of mumbly mouthed, and I crammed these two words together, and so the audience missed the whole setup, or it sounded like I said something else, and so just by some complete fluke, I coughed or something during the setup, and all of a sudden the whole thing crumbles, and that is a very frustrating thing that you have to be ready for early on. It's like, this is okay, but we'll figure out what happened. We'll just do it better next time. We still got a lot more tries.
So. Let's move on to talking about individual people, like when you're doing crowd work or when you're, you know, getting heckled intentionally or unintentionally. How much is your approach dictated by things you read about them, like their level of anger, their level of, you know, potential belligerence, their level of drunkenness or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, drunkenness is the crucial one for crowd interaction, because if somebody is intoxicated, you are not going to have a productive argument with that person. If somebody like wants to tell you their opinion and it seems clear that they're drunk, they're unable to listen and process things, I'm going to shut that down real fast. And because otherwise I'm just going to I've just taught a drunk person that this is a talking show. And that's not going to help anybody. And it's not going to help me. It's not going to help the people after me. Right. So, yeah, being able to tell early on if somebody was saying something out of the fun of disruption versus like actually has something to say. Also, I guess for me with that kind of interaction, the trick that I learned early on that's been very, very helpful is just to actually listen to what they're saying and then try to understand, because the process of you even struggling, I was like, no. So, okay, what are you saying? But why did you yell unicorns? I heard that you said that, but why did you think that was helpful? Like just the actual process of honestly trying to understand will be very funny to the rest of the audience. And if you never get there, you're like, I'm never going to get this. We have to move on. Or if you're like, oh, I see, I did mention a little while ago that I like unicorns and you have a unicorn tattoo and you thought I had to know that. Thank you. And then you just go back to like just the process of listening to them. That's not really about reading somebody's individual traits. It's as much as just instead of assuming you know what people are doing, actually hearing them out and then deciding whether or not to move on.
So it's funny, and you might teach them something about maybe you look like an idiot, you know?
Yeah, almost immediately, if you actually listen to them, then they're like, their bravery goes away.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I'm being focused on now, and...
Yeah. I wanted a little bit of attention, but not this much attention.
Right.
Or they don't know. A lot of the time, it's like people who just, like, they are a little drunk, and they, like, it's kind of like slips out, and then they're like, oh, God, I'm so embarrassed. Or they start talking, and then the person next to them elbows them. So like, and a lot of that is very general. I'm trying to think of something more specific for you of like what you notice in a person when you're talking to them. One thing that I can do is you can use a little bit of individual type crowd work to figure out a greater problem. So like one thing that happened to me a couple months back was I was doing a show and a joke that almost always works, which is about men in the gym locker room who use the hand dryer to blow dry their balls. Very good joke, always successful. And it did not work all of a sudden, and that the crowd like looked uncomfortable when I said it, and so I stopped and I was like, why are you guys mad at me right now? And it turned out that just someone else in the show had a similar joke and I hadn't heard it. So what happens is everyone got tense, and I could tell they were tense, but just like, you know, if you're reading poker people, you can tell someone's nervous,
like,
but you don't know what that means.
Yeah.
You're like, so like, I know that you're upset, but that could mean that you're upset because you want me to do A or because you want me to do B. And so with this, it was like, I know you guys are tense, but what are you upset because this is offensive, because I said something on accident that I didn't mean? And it just turns out they were like, oh, this is, did you not hear Dan's joke. It's very similar. And it wasn't even that similar. It was just like also took place in a gym, but it was enough that they were like, does he not know? Is he going to get like, is there going to be a fight with that other comic about
right.
this joke?
Does he and know he just he's got nervous. Stealing jokes or something? Yeah.
Yeah. And so all I had to say was like, oh yes. Also he goes to the gym. I guess this is a comp. I guess that guy, or I think I said something like, I guess that guy goes to his gym as well. And then everyone's like, oh great.
So you figured, okay. you figured it out during the set though, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So I asked people.
Oh,
so
asked
I was
like,
why? Like,
wait, what's the sense. Problem?
And I looked at this lady in the front row and I was like, why is everybody mad at me right now? And she was like, oh, did you not hear the other set?
That's weird.
Like, yeah, sorry. No, green room. I didn't hear it.
That's pretty funny.
So that's another, for me, in a way, again, that doesn't work as well in poker, is I could just ask people, like, why are you mad at me?
Right, right.
And
yeah.
I'm like, I'm kind of racist. I'm like, oh, totally. Oops, I'm sorry. Here's what I'm going to do instead. So you could just interview them.
Yeah, that's a good anecdote. I like that. Yeah, like you kind of like, yeah, fished for, you know, what exactly is going on here.
Yeah, because they sometimes know. They don't always know. But normally a crowd, like, it'll behave as a group, and yet individuals will know exactly why it's happening. It's a fascinating phenomenon with stuff like that.
So I've got a question about sitting down in the front row. Do most people know that they're... is it perceived, do you think, in the general population that when people get a seat up front, they're kind of signing up for, you know, being picked on? Because I feel like that's how most comedians treat it, and I think that's how a lot of comedian goers treat it. But I'm just wondering, do you think that's like widely accepted that that's like, and that's why they, you know, go after the front row more often?
Man,
it shows that you're brave, I guess. It can, even if you don't know the shorthand
of
comedy.
It's so strange because. Like a lot of comedy clubs sell the front row as a VIP experience. Like they charge more for it. Mm-hmm. And so if you had never gone to a comedy show and you go to the website and you're like, well, 25 and I might be in the back or 35 to sit up close. Well, in a music show, it's better to see, you know, or at a play, I want to sit up close. So they're like, well, I'll spend more to sit up close. And then they realize that the comics can only see the front two rows because where the lights are. So then that you're who they're going to talk to. But so I don't think most people know that certainly not all people. I don't know how many people know that that's going to happen.
Right.
I also think that's a bad thing of comedy that by default they talk like, I mean, there's this perception from the like 80s comedy, which is like, hey, that guy's shirt stupid. You guys come from a bad city. Like that kind of comedy made it like at least most of the shows that I attend. If someone talks to you in the front row, if a comic talks to you, it's to ask you questions that are not trying to make like the point is not to make fun of you. The point is just to get information to riff on, to basically like we're doing an improv scene and you're my scene partner kind of thing. So it's less adversarial. So like if you're sitting in the front row, sometimes people say like, what's the best answer when a comic asks what your job is? Like the best answer is your job. Like, I don't want you to say you're in the CIA. That's not funnier for me. I want you to say that you're an accountant and then I will try to come up with something for that. So I feel like if it's like, I don't know if everybody knows it. And I get mad when comics do like use that to make fun of people as opposed to like, I ask people questions for information. I ask people questions, not just like about the show, but if I'm like, I'm doing a thing about millennials and I'll like ask who are millennials and then I'll ask them a question about their experience as a millennial. That like, that's what I want is just, I want some validation of a theory or I want you to contribute a new idea that I can riff on as opposed to I'm here to shit on you because you sat close.
Mm-hmm. I thought of a question. Have you ever had a situation where a comedy goer was angry at you and you kind of used your reading abilities to see how angry they were and whether they might be kind of like dangerous or cause a problem? And then you either like kept joking with them and or making fun of them or laid off, depending on, you know, maybe this guy's a little unstable. Maybe I shouldn't interact with him.
Not for people being mad at me, per se, because I am as you know, you've seen me perform enough times. I am a generally inoffensive kind of person. I don't have the trouble of alienating the audience a lot. Mm-hmm. I do watch a lot of other comics alienate people and then like not read them super well. I definitely have had the experience where I start talking to somebody and I'm like, they're trying really hard to be funny. So if I say like, oh, you know, what do you do for a living? And then they're like, I'd tell you, but I have to kill you. Like, okay, this is done. You think you have a job here and I don't want to be a part of that. You clearly like the attention. Mm-hmm. Or somebody yells something and I ask him a question and they just start a conversation or a rant that I clearly don't want to be a part of. But I don't. It's so infrequent for me that audiences are mad at me about something that I don't have to do that very often. It's much more like audiences are either into it or not into it is my main thing, and then I have to figure out why they're not into it. But which could be, yeah, it could be age. It could be that they don't like me for some other reason. But it's not like. It's not usual that, because I'm just not dancing that line.
Right. Yeah. There definitely seem to be some comics that enjoy that aspect of it. Like they enjoy, you know, aggravating at least a certain percentage of their population.
Oh, yeah. Part of the fun for some, especially if they've been comics have been doing it for a really long time, sometimes riding the bull is when it's actually exciting. I saw Dave Attell here a couple years ago, and there was a where and he just seemed really bored for the first half of the show. He just seemed like he didn't care about what anyone. It was very funny, but it was like just kind of phoning it in. And then somebody yelled something, and I could see a gleam in his eye.
Like something's happening.
Yeah, finally something different, because he's just so bored of killing because he's been doing it for so long and he's so good at it that he's like, I want this to be hard. So he's excited about the challenge. And, and he's also, you know, he's the kind of comic who's like, lock the doors, turn up the lights, I'm going to talk to everybody. So in that case, sitting up front doesn't actually change anything because he'll step through the tables to talk to whoever he thinks is going to be interesting.
So I'm going to move on to some real life stuff, and you can come back to, if you think of anything else comedy-wise, we can come back to it. But I was going to ask if you think that doing comedy has made you more emotionally intelligent and perceptive of people's emotions. Do you feel like you read people better now?
So definitely I'm more perceptive, but like somehow I've gotten emotionally stupider because of it. Like it's made me into kind of a weird sociopath sometimes, where like I can be in, I'll be in a conversation and I will know, I'll be able to, like, I'll be talking for a little while and then I'll be like, also, Aaron doesn't like the story. She's mad at me for this. And then I lost you here. And then the right side of the table, like somebody walked by outside and they're all paying more attention to it, where it's like, you thought I was talking to you, but I was performing and I was analyzing you. And it turns out in a non-comedy situation, if you tell people whether or not they're enjoying something, it never makes them feel better. So like that next step where I take the information, process it, and use it to be better is something that I don't do as well off stage as on stage. I usually just be like, oh, you're not having a good time, or like, oh, you're distracted by your phone. And what they really want is for you to just keep going and not call attention to it. So
right, yeah. People do not like to feel it like they're being examined and parsed. Absolutely. For
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. And so I'm better at parsing, but then I'm terrible at that next step where I don't
keeping it secret.
Yeah.
right.
I should just use it and be like, how can I win them back? But I don't know that part.
Right. Yeah. It's like, it makes me think of, whenever you draw attention to how a conversation is going, that's a sure way to kill the conversation referencing the very thing that you're doing, because people are like, oh, we were in the moment and now you've made us analyze the things that we were doing without thinking about them.
Like a classic thing where you say like, oh, things have gotten awkward, and whether or not they had before, they have now.
Right, exactly. And that's
that's the thing that I definitely do more often now. I'm just like, because I'll be hyper aware of, while I'm talking, who is reacting and what they seem to be feeling about it. And I'll also be guess wrong sometimes. So I'll be like, oh, you got upset at this part in the story. Clearly you think this about this topic. And then I like, oh, well, great. Now I've guessed wrong. And they're like, oh no, sorry. I just was thinking about something else and I'm thinking about work, or like, and now I've made a big intense situation out of something that's not really intense.
Right. It makes me think of poker. I feel like poker definitely makes people more sensitive to, you know, paying attention to people's moods and, you know, just looking around and seeing when someone's disinterested or someone's, you know, actually enjoying themselves or whatever. I feel like you definitely have that heightened sensitivity.
Yeah,
for better or for worse.
How much of that do you think is like when people are starting out, or even when they get to your level, how much of that is subconscious versus conscious? Are you just like, it's just kind of happening that you're aware of people, or are you like, do you know that you're being aware? Does that make sense? Do you know that you're analyzing people?
I mean, I do. I'm aware. I don't know how other people view it, and I, you know, being that I concentrated on the tells and behavior, I'm definitely more attuned than the average, I think. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty good at like noticing when people are made uncomfortable, you know, And I don't know if all of that's due to poker, or maybe some of that's just due to me being interested in behavior before I got into poker, but I'm definitely good at, you know, noticing like miscommunications, like somebody says something kind of ambiguous and then somebody seems to have a weird reaction to it. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, they thought that they said, they completely misinterpreted what that person said. So I'm like, I'm really good at picking up those miscommunications and like helping out with that, you know? And,
So I'm definitely, I feel like I'm good at noticing those things and even having theories as to why they thought that, but I'm not good at helping.
Yeah. You're just going to laugh at it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or I'll be like, I'll say something that I think is cute. I'll be like, and obviously Brenda doesn't like this because she's, still upset about the breakup, and she'll be like, what? Why? No.
Yeah, you're analyzing something that you're like Sherlock Holmes. Then you're like, oh, and obviously Brenda didn't like that because, as we all know,
she had
this incident that happened 3 years ago, and she's like, what? How do you know about that?
Yeah, or there's an oil stain on her shoe that only comes from one neighborhood in the city.
Yeah.
When the reality of like Sherlock Holmes is that like he's making a lot of probabilistic guesses that even if he's right in aggregate. There's going to be a lot of weird situations where people are like, actually, no, I love
right.
Like, no, you just, it's just very uncomfortable that you're guessing.
That would be a great, that would be a great sketch comedy show. The one off the outtakes of when Sherlock's wrong, you know,
Sherlock's really elaborate, incorrect theories.
Yeah, and then he goes in this long spiel, and they're like, actually, it's just this thing that happened to me. It has nothing to do with what you said. And he's like,
yeah,
oh,
a lot of the
times
you'd be right, but in this particular case, you're just an asshole.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's pretty funny. Yeah. So Sherlock was actually just edited to show his best.
We only saw his wins. They edited out all the losses.
Mm-hmm. Right. John Holmes was a propagandist, basically.
Yeah, I mean, what good is the story of, like, Sherlock Holmes made people feel uncomfortable, and then the murderer confessed, so it worked out fine.
Yeah. Sherlock Holmes was really high and went off on this really weird tangent that made no sense,
really.
Man,
he was in the... Do you read the original books?
A little bit, yeah. I read a few of the stories, yeah.
He was injecting cocaine the whole series.
And that does make you really observant, you know. That
I mean, it also makes you not focused, and it probably makes you annoying to the people around you. It makes you think your screenplay is a good idea.
Right. It makes you think you're an amazing detective, even though you might only be a mediocre one. It's a great drug.
That's
anyway,
what this is about.
So I was going to say, related to that, have you gotten better at reading, I guess you kind of answered this, but reading real and fake laughter and smiles? That's probably a big part of a payoff for you in social or professional situations, just being like, oh, this person's just pretending.
Yeah, I I've made a nerdy study of laughter in a way that most comics don't, but I'm very interested in how people laugh. I'm especially interested in group laughter. For example, people don't just laugh when things are funny. A lot of people laugh as like a disarming social mechanism. So they'll like, you'll say something that's not funny and then laugh at it yourself in a way that's like, I'm not going to hurt you. Can we be friends? And once I noticed that, it started popping up all the time in social situations. My wife does it a lot, actually, because she's a very nice person, but she'll be like, hey, good to see you. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. It's not funny at all. But like, so I've got, there's that laughter now that I have in a jar that I can, like, anytime I hear her do that laugh, it's not that she's enjoying this. It's just she wants me to like her. And then there's this other laugh where you're actually surprising somebody and you're really catching them off guard. And then there's like a more polite laugh. And then there's also the social thing about laughs. It's so interesting. Like the dynamics of a room really affect how much an audience laughs. So the way you build a comedy club has huge impacts on how much the audience laughs. And that influences how funny they think the show was. Mm. So if you have a really low ceiling, the laughs bounce off the ceiling and it sounds to the audience like there's more laughter. So they laugh more because there's this same, like when I was talking earlier about people like glancing at each other and seeing like, is my partner laughing? Am I okay? That if you hear more people laughing, you're like, oh, I'm part of this group. We're socially laughing. Mm-hmm. So you build a good comedy room with a really low ceiling and the crowd packed tightly together because then they hear more social laughs and that makes them laugh more. And if you were to ask them afterwards, they would say they had a better time than if they were they were spread out and just kind of chuckling to themselves, mm-hmm. even though it's the same joke. So like the laugh also tricks your brain into thinking that it was better than it was. So
yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. So like the one of the best comedy clubs in the country is the Comedy Works in Denver, and it's in a basement, and it's rocks on the like the rock decorations on the walls. So there's no sound absorption at all. It's very echoey. Super low ceiling. And then they screwed the chairs into the floor so that the chairs are very, they're much closer together than anyone would normally sit, but you can't push them apart. And so crowds get in there and they're just packed in and it does not feel comfortable. And the laughter in that room is explosive. And it's one of the most fun places to do comedy because a little joke will get a laugh that just rocks the whole place. It's such a bizarre thing where it's like, I have to make you feel uncomfortable for a second because in the long run, you're going to thank me.
Yeah, it really points to the social aspects of laughter and enjoyment and
it's
everything.
So
yeah.
Much more social than I had ever thought about before. I would have said before I started doing comedy, that's like, I laugh whether something is funny or not. And so like when you do if you put a fake laugh in an audience or you play a laugh track on a show, that will not affect whether I think something is funny. I'm deciding based on the quality of it, whether its joke is good. And that is almost entirely not true. Cause like just the same way, like watching someone cry is one of the things that makes people cry a lot. Watching someone laugh is funny. It's so contagious. So that if I go to a show and everyone's having a great time, every once in a while, everyone's laughing and I'm like, what are you guys doing? This sucks. But most of the time it's just, I will still have a better time if everyone's laughing than if I'm just like watching something at home by myself.
Right. It helps. Yeah. Makes me think of that, you know, that those studies they did about audio and film and how if the audio has so much, the quality of the audio has so much impact on how people view their perception of how they enjoyed a movie or a show, you know, like if the audio is off kilter or bad, they'll come out of it and be like, you know, they'll say like, oh, this plot and the script and the acting was so bad, but it's actually due to something they're not even consciously aware of, you know?
Yeah. I do a lot of bar shows where like, it's just the amp that they had lying around. And if the microphone is cheap, people are not, they're going to lose words and then not laugh as much, or it's just going to sound unprofessional. So they're not going to be as impressed. So having good sound at a show makes a much bigger, or even if it's like too loud. I just did this club recently where they just had it like dance club volumes. And so everyone was kind of shying back the whole time you're talking, like you're yelling at them. And I didn't realize it at first because I was like, why is everyone so freaked out? Is this just a weird, there's a weird vibe in here. And then I watched the headliner and I was like, oh, it's too loud out here. If they just turned this down, everyone would have 20% better time.
That's almost all I got. This might be a weird question, but as a comedian, how do you know, how do you read your audience to know when it's the right time to pull out your penis?
You know what? I learned very early on that nobody is interested in that. That's a weird level of vanity to think like this is something that's going to make some, like, no, I mean, even if you're like really into having sex with men, there's no time where like, man, I just wish the penis came out right now. like non-contextually, it just never makes a situation better.
It's so bizarre. It just shows those guys are just on a whole nother level of weird things that we can't even understand. Like,
oh yeah,
it's so far from any sort of behavior I can understand.
It's just bananas.
I might cut that joke. Yeah, do you think
I very
should,
surprised
do you think I cut that
I was
joke?
Not ready for a joke there, and I was too. I was thinking like, I thought you were going to say when it was the right time to end a set, so I started. I guess what you're going to say, and started planning an answer. So I was taken aback, but I didn't laugh because I was like, oh, sorry, I got to change gears. Okay, that was a joke. Process work.
Do you think I should cut it out? Am I going to lose the audience with that joke?
I mean, I would definitely not do that on stage. You know, this is the thing that I talk about in my classes a lot, is that there's a kind of joke that, like, whether or not it's an objectively good joke, you've also just, for a second, you've planted the seed in everybody's head. Like, remember how sad the world is? And so even if that joke, like, is pretty funny, you've cast the world's shittiest magic spell on the crowd of just like, hey, for a second, remember sexual harassment. Or like,
you know what? Yeah.
Like, let's all think about all the horrible things we've gone through recently. And then all of a sudden that's, or if just like, you know, as a glancing in a joke, you glancingly mention homelessness, the crowd is going to be just sad for
deflated.
A second. Yeah. So you just cast a really shitty magic spell over the whole crowd.
Well, you know, the podcast was going so well. I wanted to bring people down, you know, I don't want them going out in the real world.
Well,
too
no,
happy.
Here's your real trouble is, my answer to that was so good. Do you have to keep it?
Like, all right, I'm going to keep it.
Joke to get my answer to it.
No,
I
mean, Yeah, it's a tough choice. I think I'm going to keep it. I'm used to telling bad jokes that I get hate for, so it's all right.
Well, now you've learned why that's not working.
Yeah. I need to take your class. Might help. Any other things that come to mind that we didn't talk about? Any fascinating reading people stories that you have in or out of the comedy world?
That I had put on, I thought about when I was talking to you about this. Yeah, that was pretty much it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I thought it was a good talk, and you had some very interesting things to say, so I appreciate your time coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. I look forward to it. Good luck on the show. I think this is a great idea for a podcast and a good way to take your very specific poker skill and make it more applicable so you can have more than just poker players listening.
And you can follow Alex on, what's the best place? Alex Falcone, or is it Alex_Falcone?
I got an underscore on Twitter. I really like Twitter, but I've got no underscore on Insta. So if you want to see me on Insta, you can do it all smashing. Just Alex Falcone, whatever platform you're looking for, I'll try to be there.
Yeah, look for him with or without the underscore. So,
yeah. Okay. Also, if you're a podcast fan, definitely the podcast is the best place to go.
And can you watch your set from Portland's Funniest this year?
You can.
They want to search
you
for that.
Yeah, that's on my alexfalcone.ninja, which has gotten my videos and such.
Cool. All right. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Thank you so much.